You're listening to a podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Hard Talk with me, Stephen Sacker. Thanks for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service. My guest today is a novelist preoccupied with identity and the ambiguities of belonging. Perhaps not surprising given his own background as a Pakistani who spent many of his formative years in the United States and then the UK before returning with a young family to live in his native Lahore. Mohsin Hamid went to university in America and got a desirable job in the consultancy business, but his first love was always writing. His first novel, Moth Smoke, was well received, but his big break came with the follow-up, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, a bestseller which dug deep into the uneasy relationship between the Muslim world and the West in the years after 9/11. His latest novel, Exit West, tackles another highly topical global challenge, migration, and the complex experience of both migrants and native communities in a world at once uniquely open and preoccupied with fortified borders. Why does migration frighten so many of us? Well, Mohsin Hamid joins me now. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thank you.
I want to start with this interesting idea of yours that you say are a mongrel through and through. What do you mean by being a mongrel?
Well, I was born in Pakistan, moved to California when I was 3, back to Pakistan at 9, America 18, London 30, back to Pakistan 8 or 9 years ago. And along the way, I've become a mixture of things. So I can't think of myself as just Pakistani or just British or just American. I am a mixed up kind of creature, hybrid. And that's what I mean by mongrel. It's a term that we tend to think of as kind of negative.
Yes. Do you wear that badge with pride?
I do. I think it's something we should all wear with pride because everybody is a mongrel, actually. We are descended from all sorts of people. And we have traveled and mixed through our ancestry, but also in our own lives.
But it's such an interesting statement, everybody is a mongrel, because, of course, most people don't want to think of themselves as mongrels. Indeed, the notion of belonging, having a clear identity, having a group, a tribe that is yours, that's something that seems today, in the 21st century, to be extraordinarily important to people.
I think it is very important. I think that that the sense of belonging to a group of people and having a connection to those people is very important. But what happened some time ago was the people we actually had a connection to, our immediate, you know, family and clan, was replaced by this idea of the nation state, which is kind of a fictitious connection. We don't really have a personal connection to most people of our nation.
Well, to you, maybe, but maybe not to most people. I wonder, because of your, you know, rather special international upbringing with a well-to-do family who moved with you to America and then could afford to put you through US university, and you got a very good job. You know, you're a part of a sort of a global elite, which most people in most parts of the world are simply not part of.
That's true, absolutely. That said, I mean, my childhood was spent trying to blend in with other people. So I was like a chameleon, you know, more Pakistani in Pakistan, more American in America. And as I got older, I began to be comfortable just sort of being a bit of a misfit, a sort of strange, you know, semi-foreign creature. But as I've become comfortable with this, what I find is how many other people find themselves feeling foreign. I think everybody feels foreign, actually. So, you know, the only gay child in a straight family feels foreign. The only daughter with 5 brothers feels foreign. The poet and the engineering faculty feels a bit foreign. There's a sense of, each of us has, of being a bit different or not fitting in.
Just one more political thought about this notion of identity and belonging is a very interesting statement which the British Prime Minister Theresa May came out with not so long ago. She said, if you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're in fact a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what the very word citizenship means. Do you feel yourself to be a citizen of the world rather than anywhere in particular?
I think we can have multiple overlapping citizenships. So I'm a citizen of London in the sense that I used to live here, pay taxes here. I feel something for this place, a connection to this place. I'm also a British citizen, which to Theresa May might make me a sort of a citizen of nowhere because I'm also Pakistani. But it has a real meaning to me in terms of my sense of connection to this country and my belief in abiding by the laws of this country, etc. I don't think you become a citizen of nowhere. I think the question really is, can you be a citizen of more than one place? You know, can you be a family with two parents instead of one parent, you know, as a child? I think you can. You can have multiple families that you belong to.
Your latest novel, Exit West, it's a sort of epic tale with elements of fable to it about a couple who fall in love in a city which is never named, but let's say it sounds a bit like Aleppo in Syria, a city which is pleasant but falls into the most terrible war. These two young people get caught up in it and they ultimately decide that their only hope of a decent future is to leave. You wrote it, as I understand it, while living in Lahore. Did you write it because you felt yourself in a city, Lahore in Pakistan, which was almost as fragile, as vulnerable as a city like Aleppo proved to be?
I hope that Lahore is not that fragile. But I imagine people in Baghdad and Kabul and Aleppo and Damascus and Sarajevo also felt that their cities were not that fragile. What's changed for me is the plausibility of this disaster occurring in the place where I live has grown. I think it's grown for many people in many places, and so the novel is born out of that kind of nightmare, something I hope will never happen in
Lahore. Born out of fear, really?
Yeah.
A visceral personal fear.
Yeah, I think, you know, living in Pakistan, again, I don't want to sort of contribute to the narrative that Pakistan is going to, you know, decline and fall into chaos. I don't think it's likely to do so. I think it's likely to actually do the opposite. But it's possible that it could. And so when you live in a place like that, there's a background fear that can occur. And for me, it does occur. And so the fiction is the way to explore it.
And it's a fundamentally bleak vision. I mean, you catalogue in so many interesting, emotional and intimate ways the way in which war narrows down the life of all the people captured by it in this city. And in the end, as I say, the two young people decide that escape is their only alternative. But the really interesting thing you do in this novel, because a lot of it is quite realistic and evokes images from Aleppo and Mosul and elsewhere, but then what you do is you add this sort of fantastical element where they discover a sort of magic doorway that can transport them from the hell of war to a new life, first on a Greek island, and then they make it to London. Well, what's all this fabulous magic doorway about?
Well, sometimes I think we can get closer to emotional reality by bending other aspects that we think of as being real. So, yes, the doors that they travel through don't exist according to physics as we know it. And yet we each carry around a small black rectangle in our pockets, our handbags, which is a kind of portal, you know, the screen of our phones.
The smartphone.
Yeah, through which our consciousness leaps far away from our body constantly. We also know that if we wanted people to move very cheaply, they could. There's no technological reason why people can't move all over the planet, maybe not instantaneously, but very, very easily. And so the doors, for me, are a combination of what technology is making our world feel like, a world where we are suddenly seeing and mentally present wherever we wish to be, and a way to compress the next couple centuries of human history into a very short period of time.
And yet, I suppose, the reader wonders whether you're devaluing the sheer bravery, courage, and also the risk that comes with actually escaping a war-torn city and trying to make a new life. Because whether it be Syria or whether it be sub-Saharan Africa, those who choose to leave and try to reach the rich world, and usually it's Europe, they are undertaking a terribly dangerous journey. And your description of the migrant experience doesn't include that journey at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not my intention to minimize or to say that it is not horrific the way in which refugees and migrants are often forced to travel. It is horrific and very frequently deadly. But what has happened is that by focusing so much on the journey of these people, we have created a different category of human being. Those who have crossed the Mediterranean on a small rubber dinghy or crawled underneath the barbed wire on the US-Mexico border, who are different from us. Mm. We've made them into another category of person. And then this other category can be dealt with, I think, inhumanely. When you take away that part which makes them different, they are simply people who are in a place and then left that place for another place, which every one of us has done, even if it's just leaving our parents' houses to move out on our own. And so my attempt was not to devalue, de-emphasize that part of the story, but to establish a kind of similarity between migrants and refugees and everybody else, which allows us to see them
to
as
make
us.
Them seem less different.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, what I think we're encountering is not so much that there's a conflict between two different kinds of feeling, the feeling of those who are fleeing dangerous geographies and the feeling of those who are resisting the arrival of those geographies. I think actually the feelings are very similar. The idea of losing the place where you grew up can occur both because you change geographies, and it can occur because you're starting to feel foreign in a place where you yourself have grown up.
Mm.
And so if we can recognize that the sorrow of these two experiences is similar, we can get beyond the kind of fruitless notion of inevitable conflict between these two positions.
You know, there's a phrase in the book where you describe the passage, you know, that they make from their war-torn home to a new life, which ends up being for a long time in London, but then they actually make another move to California. The passage, you say, was both like dying and like being born. Now, I'm interested in the juxtaposition of the two, because it seems to me you're saying something about your own life, too, when you lived in these different places. That, yes, a huge amount of opportunity came your way, but there was also always a sense of sorrow and loss.
There is. I mean, there's an emotional violence to moving that we often don't give enough consideration. And the echoes of that emotional violence can, you know, proceed through a lifetime and across generations. When, for example, if I were to leave Pakistan again, my children every day play with their grandparents. Let's say we were to move somewhere far away and they were to see them once a year for a week. Mm. That relationship would, in a sense, end. And there's an enormous sorrow to that. I think people do experience incredible senses of loss when they leave a place. And it's important to recognize that. When we say, oh, what has this person done? What have they given up to be here? The answer is, when we say that of the refugee or the migrant, the answer is they've given up everything. And the emotional consequences of that are huge.
And one interesting, it's only one, but one interesting element of how they try to maintain a memory of where they came from is actually the use of religion as a vehicle and prayer as a way of reconnecting. And I'm particularly interested because you, of course, are well known as the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which looked at the relationship between the West and the Muslim world through the eyes of a young man meeting an American, a young Pakistani man. And in this book, you have another young man, Saeed, who turns to prayer. And is your message that sometimes religion, and in this case the Muslim religion, can be a means of trying to maintain an identity?
Well, certainly it can be. I think that what's happened is that many...
Was it for you, by the way?
Religion as a way of maintaining my identity. I mean, I would say that in a sense, I have been made conscious of Muslims as a group because of how I'm treated by other people. So when I arrived on the Eurostar from Paris in London recently, everybody walked off the train. We'd already been through immigration. I have a UK passport. But I was stopped by somebody and asked a whole bunch of questions. And I think it's to do with belonging to this group. So yes, to a certain extent.
And did that make you feel resentful, angry? Did it actually, again, reinforce this feeling of being the other?
Yeah, it did those things. It made me sad more than those other feelings, because I think that the UK has been better than many countries at not having this sort of sense of constant surveillance.
Is that one reason you left the United States after 9/11? Because you found that you were being regarded as a potential threat?
It wasn't the reason I left. I was living in London a couple of months before 9/11 happened. But it is perhaps a reason why I didn't go back after a year, as I'd initially planned to do. You know, it was the George W. Bush administration, and a lot of wars were starting. And London felt actually very conducive as this kind of international hub of thinking, writing, people protesting the Iraq war. I felt culturally, politically, in a sense, more at home in London in those days.
And yet, in the end, your life decision was to go back to Pakistan, which brings us back to where we began this conversation with questions of identity and belonging. And it is very interesting to me that despite everything you've said about the universality of the human experience and values, you, in the end, did what so many people want to do, which is you went home.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's important is I'm not somebody who is, in that sense, sort of a rootless, you know, a mongrel wandering the earth, although I think being such a person is potentially a wonderful kind of person to be. But I'm somebody who is living, you know, in the same place that I lived as a child. after having wandered in all these places.
But in a sense, the reverse migration from the one which is the overbearing sort of preoccupation of politicians in so much of the world, that is, from the poor world to the rich world. You'd made it in the rich world. You'd had a great education. You'd become a consultant for McKinsey's, which is a sort of golden egg job. And then you decided you wanted to be a writer and you'd had written bestsellers. And you were a success in New York, in London. And yet you then decided, you know what, I want to go and make my life in Lahore, in Pakistan. And I dare say many of your friends said, you're crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people thought it was a bit of a strange decision. But many people are doing this. And what we're seeing is migration has always been a way for human beings to find something that they're looking for. Homo sapiens did not evolve on the British Isles. People came here over many thousands and thousands of years, and they keep coming. They don't necessarily stay. So people whose ancestors were in Britain have moved on to America, California, whatnot. Some of them might come back this way. I think we can migrate and return. But one thing, yeah.
Well, no, this is where, yeah. This is where I struggle to keep up with you.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me when you talk about the migration of the future, in which you say, and I'm going to quote you here, I imagine that centuries hence, when people are finally free to move as they please around our planet, they'll look back at our moment now and wonder, just as we wonder about those who kept slaves, how people who seem so modern could do such cruel things to their fellow human beings, like caging them up as animals. Your implication being, you know, we'll reach this sort of heavenly moment where migration is just completely normal, acceptable, easy and accessible to everybody on this planet. I put it to you, that flies in the face of everything about the human condition and human history.
I think human history and human condition is a march towards greater equality. So until recently, the idea that black people would be slaves in the southern part of America 150 years ago was accepted as common wisdom. The idea that women were inferior to men, or that gay people shouldn't have the same rights as straight people, or that religious people and atheists should have fundamentally different rights. I mean, all these things have changed.
But what hasn't changed, and we can say, you know, in 2018 that we see the strains of populism and nationalism and building fences and borders and fortifications today. We can say that there is something about all of human history where, yes, there are constant movements of people, usually invasions which involve violence, and those movements of people generally have involved epic amounts of killing and bloodshed.
I don't think they have. I don't think that's true. I think the experience.
Well, look at the history of North America, South America, the Central Asia, almost any geographical part of the world is full of such stories.
Yes, I mean, there has been violence associated with migration, but it isn't necessarily the case. So in North America, there was a kind of genocide where the pre-Columbian population of America was effectively wiped out by those who came in. But, you know, I have brown skin because for tens of thousands of years, lighter-skinned people have come into the darker-skinned parts of the Indian subcontinent where I live, and they didn't actually massacre each other and result in just lighter-skinned people surviving. They stuck around and intermixed. And most of human history, I think, is like that. It is not genocide after genocide. I think most often it is that we don't engage in genocide, which is why we're shocked by genocide.
I just wonder, and I sort of alluded to this earlier, whether you would acknowledge that your rather optimistic view of where humanity is going, particularly on this question of migration and the intermingling of peoples, is reflective of having a rather gilded life.
I think probably it is. But that said, I think there are two very strong reasons to believe that it is going to happen. One reason is the pressure of migration is going to become enormous. If we truly are going to resist it, we will no longer be able to, in Europe, for example, simply outsource to Libya and Turkey the job of preventing migrants. We will have to actively kill the people who want to come, to erect very violent barriers in their way. We will have to catch those who get through. We will have to catch those who try to help those who get through. We will begin to pursue.
Well, you're saying there's no middle ground. There is no control that is possible in a humanitarian way.
Well, there never has been. Like, when have people stopped moving? You know, we've always moved. It is the nature of humanity. We've never stopped moving and been confined to geographies in this way. But also, the population of Africa was a small fraction of Europe's 50 years ago. It'll be several multiples of Europe 50 years hence. And as climate change occurs, people are going to move. What are we going to do? So one is, I think we won't have the stomach, I hope, to inflict the kind of atrocities and to create the kind of totalitarian societies that will resist this. But the second thing about it is we actually need to think of ourselves as humans and less divided in the sense of nations and tribes to solve the most pressing problems we face. Climate change cannot be solved by countries thinking, you know, just of national self-interest. The issue of migration, I don't think, will be addressed in this way. But also, the most important issue, perhaps, is the issue of how we will regulate and manage technology. You know, we're on the verge of giving birth to intelligent machines that can think. How are we going to regulate this? How are we going to share the benefits of this? They could potentially create great surpluses. But if those surpluses accrue to just a dozen trillionaires in California and the rest of us lose our jobs, it's not going to be a very pleasant planet. I think all of this stuff requires a more human thinking.
And there you sit in Pakistan today. So I want to end by coming back to your current life in Pakistan. You've left California where, as you just said, so many of the sort of developments in tech are coming from. And you're now living in a country where there are 200 million people, many of whom are living in poverty. And you have said, very recently, you said of your life in Pakistan, these are incredibly disheartening times. I feel more depressed now than I have for a long time about the political direction of my country. Because the question here has become, who is Muslim enough? And after 70 years of nationhood, the answer appears to be nobody is Muslim enough. So for all of your optimism about the sort of what humanity can achieve and the values that we all, idealize, actually, your own home, you seem to think, is in very profound trouble.
It's in trouble, but I think it can get out of that trouble. And I think it's actually very important for us to begin to articulate optimistic visions of politics, the future, culture, because what we are facing right now is the dominant of nostalgic, pessimistic visions. If you are pessimistic about our ability to have a more equal world, you tend to think it's a good idea to make America great again.
Yeah, but this, quiet. Thanks for putting that phrasing, because I just noted down Donald Trump's first tweet of 2018 was directed directly at Pakistan. $33 billion, he said, that we've given them, and they've given us nothing but lies and deceit, taking our leaders for fools, giving safe haven to the terrorists that we are hunting for in Afghanistan. Again, seems to me that right now you're living in a part of the world that, given the messages being sent by Donald Trump and the current American administration, is going to be a cockpit of tension and trouble.
Yes, but what we're seeing is an older generation that has migrated to becoming older is in power right now. And disproportionately, they want these kind of barriers. But younger Americans disproportionately did not vote for Donald Trump. And younger Britons disproportionately did not vote for Brexit. Younger people are much more comfortable with the kind of openness that I'm talking about. And this is how human civilization evolves. It's not that we suddenly become enlightened. It's that the older generation, people like us, who have more closed-minded views, eventually die. You know, we each achieve the great Brexit in the sky. And then the younger people who are left will take us into domains we can't imagine, including people moving around the world in a way that today we think of as very strange.
You're one of the most optimistic people I've ever met.
Well, I'm a dad. You know, it's sort of my job to be optimistic. But also, I think it's very important because pessimism at this moment is feeding political reactionary thinking.
We have to end there. Mohsen Hamid, thank you very much for being on Hard Talk.
Thank you.
That was an edition of Hard Talk presented by me, Stephen Sacker. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.